Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Administrative assistant, office manager, sales business analyst, customer development account associate, and senior sales planning analyst are all roles that I've successfully held. And I'm having a conversation about a sales planning manager opportunity this week. A history degree opens the door to so many lucrative opportunities as long as you're willing to take a few risks and work hard. Bonus, getting to wipe the smirk off people's faces when they find out you have a history degree and are ready to lay into you about how useless your education in the humanities is. My guest today, Gustavus graduate Allie Shervin Boyd, emailed me this terrific autobiographical quote in early 2018, and I've had it posted prominently next to my office door ever since. Whenever the opportunity presents itself, I read it aloud to students thinking about majoring in history. I love the quote for the way it is constructed, and especially the way it so confidently, proudly, and rightly so, challenges head-on the notion that a degree in history or any other humanities discipline is a ticket to nowhere, except perhaps a low-paying job. Allie graduated summa cum laude from Gustavus in 2010 with majors in history and Russian studies. Following graduation, she entered the corporate world, securing positions in sales analytics with the Fortune 500 companies Nestle and Clorox. In 2019, she joined DataCite, formerly the Merrill Corporation, where she is currently Principal Revenue Operations Analyst. I can think of no better advocate for how humanities education is fulfilling and empowering, and I've been eager for this opportunity to speak with her about that and her work as a humanities major in the corporate world. So, Allie, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you on.
Thanks, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you. And I know we said we had lunch some years ago, but this will do for now. We'll get in person again. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up. Why don't we start there?
Sure. So I grew up in the eastern suburbs of the Twin Cities. I didn't make it very far. I still live there. So for folks who are familiar with, you know, that part of the Twin Cities, I grew up in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, graduate of North St. Paul High School.
Oh, yeah.
And I currently live in Lake Elmo, so get to enjoy the beautiful St. Croix Valley all year round.
Oh, it's so pretty. I'm envious.
It is. It's gorgeous. There's so much to do.
Oh, yeah. That is, God, the St. Croix, it's absolutely gorgeous. Let me ask you about your parents. They didn't go to Gustavus, did they? Are you
They did not. So I'm actually a first generation.
You're a first gen. You're kind of like me.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. My parents, are actually not even from Minnesota. So I'm a little bit of an unusual bird. They're both transplants. And so I don't have kind of the typical Minnesota experience, at least that most of my peers had, which is, you know, your parents are from here and your grandparents are from here and their parents are from here and then their parents are from Europe. But, so I'm a little bit of an odd duck, but my dad is originally from North Dakota and my mom is from upstate New York. Neither of them live in those states now. They've kind of all dispersed and here I am still in Minnesota. But my dad, was in the trades. So he did home remodeling for most of his career. Okay. And then my mom actually worked for the majority of her career at Medtronic, which will be familiar, not just to Minnesotans, but folks all over the country, wonderful medical device company. As she worked, you know, variously in IT, in legal, in global trade. She's a data gal as well. So she did go back to school as an adult, and I believe she got her MBA. But, you know, if we're talking about templates for how to do work in the corporate world, she was definitely an influence on.
That's interesting. Yeah. So I think you told me that. I forgot. And I talked to your mom at one point. I remember after we had lunch that she went on for her her MBA. What did she wind up doing after that with the MBA? Was that wasn't Medtronic still, or was it?
It was actually. So she, I believe at the time she was in legal and then she swapped over to global trade and having that MBA kind of boost, especially with things like statistics, right? I remember her taking a couple of statistics courses and just having that additional knowledge, right, to help support her in her new role. She really crushed it.
That's great. That is a great role model for you.
She just retired. So last
yeah,
year
that's right.
Retired.
Where she went to Florida.
Kentucky.
Kentucky. That's right. Kentucky. Why Kentucky? Come on. I wonder what she doesn't
horse,
do horse.
Horse. She absolutely
it is.
Does.
Oh
it is. God. Yep.
Wow.
She had a dream. Both she and her younger sister had a goal to move to Kentucky and to have a hobby farm when they retired, and they have achieved it. So very
that's
inspiring.
Fantastic. Wow. More inspiration for you.
Right.
Did you ride horses when you were younger?
No, we didn't have them here. Okay. We were very much a suburban situation.
Pull up the horse to the garage or something.
Yeah.
You know.
We have a different kind of horsepower rolling around here. Both my husband and I are very much into the classic car scene.
Oh, really? So no kidding.
Yeah, that's our different kind of horsepower.
Well, I want to come back to that later. I'm making a note right
yeah.
now.
We might have to schedule another hour, but sure.
Yeah, that's cool. What were your interests as a kid? Like in, you know, pre-high school, high school, were you, I mean, you weren't already interested in Russian, were you? History?
But I was.
Oh, really?
I was. So made me just give a little bit more background. I think this is becoming more common, but my parents separated when I was about 8, divorced the same year.
Okay.
And so I think that actually is a much more common. So my life as a young child became very regimented in terms of, you know, you're at this house 1 week and you're at this house the next week, right? And
right.
Very, you know, very different environments depending on, you know, blended families and parenting styles. So school really became my stable place, right? And that was where I found a lot of outlet for my interests, right? And even prior to that, right? Like I was a very young reader. I think I was reading even before I was in preschool. And I give credit to my parents to, you know, starting reading with me very early.
Yeah, you're lucky.
Yes, I'm very lucky. And then, you know, just having a mom who was already working in the tech sector, right? She was doing some things like that. So we had a computer in our house. I remember there was a dinosaur typing program. I don't even remember what it's called, but I remember learning to type at, you know, 6 or 7 years old with the typing program. So, and that moved very quickly into Excel, believe it or not, I want to say around 10. And it was really, rudimentary, right? Like type some stuff in, sort it, you know, play around. It was a lot of, you know, experimenting and learning. My parents, both of them, despite being separated, right, were very aligned in their parenting, recognized in me the skill sets, right, for pretty much anything, right, it at that young elementary education
right.
age into middle school, into high school. I had always been interested in history, so I mentioned that my mom is from upstate New York, and they have a little bit more, you know, recorded history from the Western European point of view out on that side of the country than we do in Minnesota. Obviously now we know there's more sides to history than
exactly.
what some people said.
Right.
But yeah. even then my grandmother too was also an influence in that, because when we would go to visit, right, she would say, you know, here's the stuff you know about, right? Here's the Revolutionary War stuff, here's this, here's that, but here's also the history of the Mohawk Indians, right?
Oh my gosh.
And so mm-hmm. she was very intentional about making sure that I knew that there was more than just what was you know, presented to me in school, right?
That's fantastic.
And,
wow.
Yeah.
Was she a teacher? Was she your grandmother teacher?
No, she raised 5 children. She's a very civically minded person. So she did a lot of stuff. She drove school bus for a time, right? Hmm. She supported my grandfather in his 30-year career at GE.
Wow.
And then after that, he began a farm with my uncles. And so that's a farm that's still going today. But she
wow.
was always, my grandmother, and unfortunately she has Alzheimer's right now.
I'm sorry.
So it's a thing, right? Yeah. But she really impressed upon me and on my mom, you know, there's so much to learn. You can never stop learning. There's always more to learn or more to investigate, right? And so, you know, as a child visiting my grandparents in upstate New York and being able to see history, you know, right there, right? Like I remember visiting my great aunt in Schenectady, New York, and the house next to the house that she lived in, there's a big sign, right? The Eastern states in particular do a really good job of denoting historical locations. Yeah. So big sign on the house next door, like George Washington slept here. And I mean, every little kid who goes to George Washington. So like just that fascination with history really early. Yeah.
I love this. One of the reasons, as I say a million, probably on every episode, is I love doing this because I learn so much about people that I didn't know before. So that is really cool. My dad was a bit like that. He was. That's kind of, I think, where my, a lot of it was, he was a World War II vet. And it wasn't about war as glory, as far from it. The only thing it was about was, I didn't realize it at the time. He was teaching us historical contingency, you know, but for this, you know, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be your dad. A little heavy for a kid to hear, you know, but still.
Right.
It was amazing. He's so that's really cool about your grandmother. Yeah. Is that your mom's? That's your mom's.
It's my mom's upstate mom. New York. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And so show in the Schenectady area, is that where they were?
Yeah. They still live there today. That's cool. So just having that exposure to that kind of just like, and who's to say, right, when a passion becomes evident, how you know, but you know, you just go, all right, like, cool.
You know. Okay.
So I brought that home with me, right? And to be fair, on the other side of my family, right, there's in North Dakota, right, my grandparents lived on, you know, a plot of land, and, you know, on the other side of the bean field, there was an old schoolhouse, right? So I think my introduction to history came through kind of buildings first, as it often does for many people. And then, you know, with the advent of cable television, I love when people, like when historian people get snooty about the History Channel, because like, I think we can all agree, right? There's not a whole lot of history going on the History Channel.
But the War Channel, yeah.
Right. Or the Alien Channel, I think. Yeah, or the Alien Channel.
Yeah.
But if you're saying that as a child, you didn't find it interesting, or especially for millennials, right? If you didn't get sucked into learning about history via the History Channel, you might be lying.
You're lying. No, you're lying. Totally lying. I think
I was sitting in a History 200 class at Gustavus, and we were doing the whole, like, how did you come to history, right? And I said, I came to history through this and through History Channel. And so one of the other students, I don't remember who, kind of sneered, and I think it was Eric Carlson, who was our professor, and he kind of looked around. And he goes, "How many people got interested in history because of the History Channel?" And almost everybody raised their hands. And I was like, yeah, "That's right."
Yeah, I don't like that snootiness, including about movies. No. You know, I mean, it gets you in. For me, it was what was a show called The Big Picture about World War II, because I was born in 1953, not that long ago.
Anyway, yeah,
just all that stuff, right? And I think it's really cool what you're saying about the buildings too. Mm-hmm. That's neat for me. Partly it was, you know, going to the Museum of Science Industry as a kid and being told by my dad, and then seeing, I guess, maybe some brochures or something, that was the, you know, the Great White City, the Columbian Exposition. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Wow. This is, and still here. This is awesome. So totally understand. I think that's fantastic. So were you doing, did they have straight up history courses in your high school, or was it more like social studies?
They did. So they had, you know, regular social studies through middle school, and then into high school, they start breaking it out, right? So you have your European history, and you have, you know, other types, earlier types of history, right?
Right.
And then, you know, having been an accelerated student, I had the opportunity to do AP courses. So AP American history, AP European history, things like that. And that really cemented the fact that I just loved history. It also helped that I had a wonderful teacher. I think she's still around. Her name is Marie Elverum. She's certainly not teaching anymore, but I think she is still active in the community. And having, again, we talk about, you know, these influences in your life that recognize in you the things that you are interested in.
That's right.
Having her kind of recognize that in that skill set and that passion in me was really helpful. Although, believe it or not, I did not set out to go to Gustavus as a history major.
Well, that was my next question. Yeah. Go ahead.
So it also kind of became apparent as I was growing up that I had a strong interest in and a propensity for languages, right?
Okay.
And so as is typical, right, in public education, you don't typically get the opportunity to study languages until you hit high school. And then right. if, you know, Spanish is very frequently the only language right. on offer. I was lucky enough to go to a high school where they had three, Spanish, German, French. And I went, well, I don't really care for German. and everybody takes Spanish, so I'm going to take French. And I loved it. And I loved it not just for the linguistics piece, but right, the historical piece. Like, French Revolution isn't anything to shake a stick at. Right.
You can spend a lifetime on that. Yeah.
Right. And the historic piece and the cultural piece, the influence, the Francophone world, right, is humongous. And I used to get that question a lot of like, well, why would you take French? Like, are you going to go live in France? And I'm like, well, you know, our neighbors to the north kind of speak French, and the whole continent of Africa almost speaks yeah. French. And what about New Orleans? And
someone should compile a list of the kinds of questions we get asked.
It's history. Unbelievable.
Anyway, yeah. So, so did you come to be a French major?
I did. Wow. I did. So what I knew at the time that I also wanted to study Russian, which wasn't on offer at our high school. I don't think it is even now, despite local.
Where did that interest come from? Do you know?
You know, I have no idea. I get asked that question all the time. I have zero idea. I'm not Russian, right? I don't have any Russian. I have a little bit of like Polish ancestry. So if you think about how things change geopolitically over time, right, there might be a little Russian in there. But you know, it's not culturally, it's not my heritage. Linguistically, it's not my heritage. It just was so interesting to me. It was a puzzle, right? Because they don't use the same alphabet, yeah. right? The history in itself is enough to, you know, keep you busy for a lifetime because right. it's just so
fascinating,
interesting, right? Yeah. So I knew that when I was looking for a college, I knew that I wanted a smaller college. I knew that I didn't want to go too far from home. I entertained the idea, right, of kind of Gustavus's other colleges that are in the Gustavus tier, right? Like Oberlin and Middlebury okay. and Carleton. And
all the small liberal arts colleges.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Midwest. Yeah.
Yep. And so I was kind of, I knew I wanted a small college. I didn't want to go too far. And I knew that I wanted to take Russian, and finding at a big university, you can find all the languages, right?
Sure.
But finding a smaller college that had that offered both French and Russian was a bit of a challenge, and Gustavus was one of them that did. And then I also knew that I wanted the capability to study abroad, so that factored into my decision. And then one of the big things that factored into my decision was how much financial aid, right, would I be able to receive?
Right.
And when it came down to it, it was actually cheaper for me to attend Gustavus than it was to attend the University of Minnesota.
Wow.
One because there's less competition for resources, right, at a smaller school. Gustavus has fantastic financial aid program. I feel like the statistic, and you can tell me because you probably have more accurate information, but I want to say something like 80% of Gustavus students receive some kind of aid.
Yeah, it's something like that. 77.
It's very high.
And by the way, the financial aid packages is only getting better. I mean, the whole offers, unbelievable. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I had a third of my education paid for due to the, I want to say, the president's scholarship.
Sure.
Which you have to have a 3.5 GPA min. To maintain it. But I mean, what an opportunity, right?
Yeah. The people, this is an aside, but the people who go on about the, you know, they're looking at the sticker price, right?
And
very few students, not just at Gustavus, pay the full, that's one of the problems higher ed faces. But anyway,
I won't say that I didn't have loans, right? I walked out of school with some loans. That's a separate conversation.
Yeah, same here.
But, yeah, but in terms of, you know, the value that I got, it was an easy choice the minute I visited campus, right?
That's fantastic.
It checked all the boxes from a data gathering perspective, but from a gut perspective, I walked on campus and I went, oh, this is where we're going to be.
Well, as other listeners, regular listeners know, and I assume we have regular listeners, I only half joke. Like, if we could just get everyone to come do the visit, there's something about the visit that is amazing. Because so many times when I ask, you know, why Gustavus, That comes up as it just did with you, and people mention that. So, and we just need to get everyone to come. Go nowhere else. 100%. Just visit Gustavus.
Just visit Gustavus.
Yeah.
Don't visit in February. But
yeah, exactly. Right. So, I mean, a lot of Gusties have family connections, but it sounds like you did not, right?
I did not.
First gen. Yeah. Yeah. I have to find out. Am I technically a first gen? My mom went to a 2-year teacher's college. So I don't know if that makes me, that's it for me and my, at least among my parents. But oh, by the way, there's a first gen organization on campus now. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
of faculty and students, and I think administrative staff. Yeah, it's really cool. I'm not yet a part of it because I have to figure out if I qualify. But anyway, yeah, it is cool. So, so you come to Gustavus, and what was your let's just talk a little bit about your experiences there, academic, co-curricular. I mean, memorable experiences, favorite classes, favorite co-curricular, etc.
I mentioned the History 200 class earlier, and I think by consensus, at least everyone in the class had said this was the best History 200 class ever. So that definitely is.
That's great. And that's our methods course.
Yes, yeah.
And Eric Carlson, now retired, but taught at Gustavus for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. And truthfully, I mean, I don't, with the passage of time, right, my specific memories start to dim. It's been 14 years since I graduated from college. I have more of, you know, formative feelings. So I think one of the things that was formative was deciding to, we talked about, I entered Gustavus as a French major. I intended to have a French major and a Russian minor, and I wasn't going to have anything to do with history, even though it was an interest. And then I took a 300 level class as a freshman with Tom Emmert in the spring of 2007 because it looked interesting to me. And I asked, why is there, you know, is there any barrier to me? Because some courses rightly have prerequisites, right?
Right. Yep.
And it was nationalism in the Balkans.
Oh, perfect.
And God bless Tom Emmert. He's like, of course you can take this class. And that was the class where I went, there's so much more I have to learn, and I need to.
That's fantastic.
Be a history major. So I and then of course in I started taking Russian right away. I had waited a long time to be able to do that. I had two fantastic professors, Dennis Cernkovich, of course, and
that's
then
great,
Karen Rosenflans, who I believe now teaches at St. Scholastica.
Okay, yeah, I know she's not at Gustavus anymore. Dennis is retired emeritus, and Tom as well. Yes. Yeah, two great profs.
But those were the three professors that my first year I just went, oh my gosh, like, what? And not to at all disparage our French department, because they are fantastic as well.
Not at all.
But I just went, I only have so much time in the day. I can't have three majors. I'll go crazy.
No, God, please. I hope. Yeah. Students, current students, listen, you don't need three majors. That's a new trend.
Don't.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know what? It's not going to really get you anything.
Exactly.
It's right. It's more about what you do with it than how many you have.
You know.
And so that, making that decision, which at the time was a really scary decision, right? The plan had been in place for a couple of years already of I'm going to be a French major and that's it, right?
Right.
And so making that decision and having the support of the professors in making that decision was really formative.
I'm glad you made the decision. And, you know, this is another example. And what you just said is just great, the plan. So I love when people come to Gustavus or just in general college with this, you know, plan, and then it blows up. Right? Because I think that's what should happen. I mean, ideally for me, you wouldn't have a plan, especially at a liberal arts college. And then, you know, you did not set out to be a history major. And had you not taken that course with Tom Emmert, who knows, right? Maybe you would.
Right.
You know, we just don't know. So I love that. There are important lessons there for students and parents, current students, prospective students who feel everything has to be sorted out in advance.
Yeah.
My life depends on, you know, my future depends. No, absolutely.
I'm wildly jealous of people who do have it figured out, right? Like if you know what you want to do and you're certain, great. But like play that to the hilt, because it's an advantage that not a lot of people have. Because
yeah.
Most people don't know yeah, truly so many, what so many it is those, they want to do.
So I think so many of those people, at least some who think they know, it changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never, you know. But anyway, glad you became a history major and a Russian study, both Russian language and Russian studies. Were they the same one and the same Russian?
It is. Gustavus at the time did not offer a Russian language major. They offered a Russian minor. And okay. They offered a Russian studies major, which had, you know, linguistic and cultural and historic components.
Okay. Yeah, I love that. By the way, mm-hmm. I took one of my favorite history teachers who is still with us, thank God. I think he's 90, 91. Some of his former students, I'm among them, of different ages, we mm-hmm. Zoom with him on occasion. Stan Moore, who grew up in Minnesota. He taught Russian history in high school, which I took.
Oh,
I
didn't my
take
goodness.
The language. I don't even know if we had the language. I took German, sorry. And because I didn't want to take Spanish. You know, everyone was taking Spanish.
Right. But,
and my mother claimed of some German ancestry. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But Stan taught Russian history, Russian culture. I just loved it. And then I took another course in, I guess, Russian history and culture and art in college. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to get to Russia? Have you gone?
I did. I studied abroad.
Okay.
In my junior, senior, spring semester of my junior
wow.
year. So 15 years ago. And okay. I'm a little bit devastated because given the current yeah. geopolitical issues, right? I don't think I'm ever going to be able to get back.
No, it's sad.
I've been trying to convince my husband for probably the last 10 years, like, hey, let's go visit because you never know what's going to happen. And guess what? Some stuff happened.
Yeah.
And so I think of it often and fondly, right? That would be one of the things that I would say, even if you're not a language major, right? Gustavus has an incredible study abroad program. And if you can find a way to get to, a country
yes.
where English isn't, you know, the second right. most predominantly spoken language, where you right. really need to, you know, put some work in to make it. It is one of the most, and like, I did not have a good time in Russia. Let's be completely factual and honest.
Why not?
I ended up in the hospital.
Oh, no.
I was very ill. I ended up in the hospital like three times. I had a really tense relationship with my host mom, right? It was a rough time. But I still wouldn't trade it. It was incredibly, the fact that I had the opportunity to have that experience is still just one of the biggest gifts, right? It was really wonderful just to be able to have that experience.
I couldn't agree more. I went to Mexico as an undergraduate with my then girlfriend who was mm-hmm. fluent in Spanish. I was not fluent in Spanish, but you know, it was the same thing. I just loved it. Transformative. I still have a gift our landlady gave me on my shelf. You know, I still have that all these many years
yeah.
later. My sister-in-law, my wife's sister, she was a Russian studies, whatever it was called, at Williams mm-hmm. College, like you. And then has gone, not recently, but gone a few times, both as a student and then later as a teacher. So I'm envious because I've not been, and I really, yeah. I feel the same way. Am I ever going to get to go?
It's truly, I lived in St. Petersburg, so not in the capital of Moscow. And St. Petersburg, if you know anything about architecture, it was built by Peter the Great, who hired almost exclusively Italian architects. So you get there and you're like, am I in Venice or am I in Russia? Like he had a vision, man. If you read one biography of one great Russian, it's, you got to read Peter the Great.
Yeah. What's it? What's biography. The, there's a great biography. Oh my God.
Robert, I want to say Robert Service, but that might not be right.
Robert's right. Anyway,
maybe Robert Massey. It could be him. As well.
I think that might be it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge book. But great book. And you're lucky. I mean, you just made a great pitch for a study away, whatever it's called now.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Which is excellent. We do have a good program. And
yeah.
And even study away within the country for some students
yeah.
too. Who
can't, yeah, depending on what your major is and what your goal is, what you're hoping to achieve. But I don't think there are other experience that can parallel study abroad
for the
richness that you get out of it.
Yeah, totally agree. What – the other question I had for you, did you do co-curricular while you were there? Did you music or sports or anything?
I w- was active in, I'm not sure what it's called now or even if it still exists, but Proclaim, which is the Christian student organization.
I think it's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. I was active in Russian Club. I don't think there was a history club at the time. It may have been in its infancy.
Yeah. It was fledgling. We do have a club now. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't participate in too many extracurriculars. And part of that was because of the aforementioned scholarship that had a GPA requirement.
Right.
And looking back, people love to say like, well, do your life so you don't have any regrets. No, that's dumb. Have a lot of regrets because that's how you learn. I look back, right. You mentioned up in your intro that I graduated summa cum laude, which means, my GPA was obviously fairly high.
Bravo.
And well above the minimum requirement for the scholarship. So looking back, I actually wish I had done more, whether it was even just doing stuff for CAB, right? Campus Activities Board. And they do a lot of great work to bring interesting things and events to campus speakers. And I look back on the time and I go, well, Allie, you probably could have, taken an hour out of your day and gone to listen to this interesting speaker or gone to this event to, build community a little bit more. So I was active in a few things, but I was most active in my study.
Yeah, that's how I was. And I didn't really know. I went to Northern Illinois University, so a big state school, for my BA and MA. And I didn't really know anyone at the time who was – and it wasn't a small liberal arts college, first of all. But I didn't know any fellow students, and that may say more about the people I hung out with than anything else, who were doing all this stuff, on top of the academics. And so when I came to Gustavus as a prof, that was really – in some ways hard for me as a prof. These students are doing so, and I think still it's almost, well, you well know you were a student there. Some students just do too much. I mean, even apart from the impact on academics, it can take a toll, right? We only have so much time and so much energy. And there's this thing called sleeping that's important.
Right. But, I'm going to plug the Gustavus mentoring program for a moment. So I'm not currently.
Oh yeah. I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not currently active as a mentor, but I mentored for, I think, 3 or 4 years in recent years. And it's funny that you talk about students trying to do too much, right? I had, I think it was my last mentee. She is an absolute rock star, right? I believe her primary major was public policy. I can't remember. She's a public policy brilliant. I think she was featured in the Gustavian, the quarterly publication that comes out. But we were having a conversation one day and she said, I really want to do this. And I really want to do this. And I said, she had an opportunity come her way that she just felt like she couldn't pass up, but she felt like she couldn't take on any additional, stuff either. And I said, could you take one thing off your plate and add this thing? Or could you take two things off your plate and add this thing? Because there is something to be said for not trying to be all things to all people, even if you love it, even if you think it's going to be beneficial to you in the long run. Like mental health, right, is a perennial conversation the last couple of years.
Yes.
And it's like, give yourself some rest.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I'm seriously. And I don't know what it was like for you in high school. When I was in high school, there wasn't this emphasis on you've got to be doing all these different things. And I don't know if that's where this comes from or just students think that's what they need to do to get ahead after graduation. But what you just said is excellent. I mean, it's great advice. And that's another quote, by the way. I may take this out of the podcast and put to my door. Seriously.
Go for it.
Yeah, I have a whole list of Allie
I definitely, I mean, let's be truthful, right? I need to take my own advice more often than not.
Sure.
As an adult, I'm still probably doing a little bit too much.
We all do.
But
when I look at your when I look at your CV, I think, oh my God, I don't know how you do it. And this is that's a good segue actually to post Gustavus and work. So you come out, did you go right into the corporate world right from graduation?
I did, but in a little bit of an unorthodox way. So I had, my original intention was to go to graduate school for a Russian studies, a master's in Russian studies, because I wanted to continue that work. A little thing happened in 2008 where the economy just went
bonkers. That was called the Great Depression.
And so graduating in the spring of 2010, the economy really hadn't recovered. I'm as a 22-year-old, right, looking, going, all right, I got these bills that are going to come due. And if I went to grad school, I could defer them. But looking at the cost of graduate school, the the funding is much more competitive in graduate school, especially I was headed for the University of Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I just couldn't get funding. And part of that was, you know, not necessarily knowing, I didn't do a very good job of understanding the things that I needed to do to secure that funding. It certainly wasn't as simple as keep your GPA up and we will give you money.
Right.
It's a little bit different.
That's right. Yep.
And so I think I want to say April of my senior year, I was rejected for funding for my master's degree. And I made the decision to just say, you know what, I'm not going to take on another, $100,000 in debt, because at the time Madison was $50,000 a year for that program.
That's too much.
I don't even know what it is now. And I look back and I think that was, from a financial perspective, right, that was the best decision I could have made. I don't come from intergenerational wealth, right? My parents did a very good job, providing for us. I grew up firmly middle class, but something just in me went, oh, I don't think I want to take on that much debt, especially when the job landscape is like not that good.
At that moment, yeah.
Right. And so I, this is going to sound horrible because people would just be horrified now that this is how I got my first job. But I graduated. I moved in with my then boyfriend, now husband. And I went on Craigslist and I looked for a temp job. And like, now you're like, okay, well, you would have been kidnapped by now, right? Like nobody uses Craigslist for anything remotely legitimate now. But I found a temporary job through a temp company. What's it called? I forget what they're called now, but it was called Adecco at the time. It was a very common temporary, contract work company.
Okay.
And I did, like, I worked for a week in a warehouse doing a contract for GE, which is, I mentioned earlier in the conversation, my grandfather worked for them for 30 years. So that was a weird circle.
Come full circle. Yeah.
So I schlepped boxes in a warehouse for a week. One night we did a contract for Nielsen. So the folks who, gather data and provide ratings, we did a movie night data gathering for them. And then I got a contract as an administrative assistant for Nestle's sales team that called on Target. And it was really just, well, I need a job, right? I've got bills coming due. I don't have any immediate plans to go to graduate school in the near future. So I'm just going to go to work. And it really, like we talked before about the plan not coming to fruition.
Yes.
So now this is the second time, right, that the plan has not come to fruition.
That's right. Yeah.
And it turned out to be the greatest opportunity in my life, which is funny because people, a lot of times people tend to look down on admin work. It's like, I think I didn't even need a college degree to do it. Right. I think the requirement was a high school degree.
But you were in the door.
Yep. So as a contract worker, I did very well, right? I tried to do the best job that I could. And then when the opportunity came up to be hired as an actual Nestle employee, I took it. I was like, this is, I had a lot of friends at the time who weren't working or, struggling to find work or underemployed. And I went, well, of course I'm going to do this, right? It was also, Nestle has a lot of name recognition, right? I was working. They made like my four favorite candy bars.
I was going to tease you, but I wondered.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they've since divested their candy business, but like, how can you say no when there's candy on the premises?
Right. Exactly.
And so it was, I had had it, during my Gustavus time, I had worked in the Modern Languages, Literatures and Cultures office in Convict.
Like as an assistant or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Assistant to, I hope she's still there. Jenny Tolleson.
Oh, Jenny. Yeah. Please, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that was my work study job. So I had had experience working in an office setting. And so it was very easy for me to translate that experience that I had into my time at Nestle. And then while I was working for Nestle, I started to track some of my responsibilities and the things that I was doing. And eventually that led to the opportunity to step into a business analyst role, because what I was doing was tracking data and analyzing it and noticing trends and patterns and taking those trends and patterns and saying, well, if we change this, then this might happen, right? We might be able to increase our performance, or we might be able to answer these questions more quickly, right? And that enabled me to, once the business analyst role on the convections desk came up, so you want to talk about candy, like that, it, for 2.5 years, it was my job to think about candy every day.
I'm thinking about, is this true? Like, I'm imagining if you work for a cigarette company, there are bowls of cigarettes, and they have bowls of candy everywhere. You just help yourself.
100%. Okay. 100%. So like, I still say that was my most, like, people ask me like, oh, what was your most fun job? And that was truly my most fun job. It was, there was always something new, right? Candy everywhere. I worked, aside from the actual product, I worked with some fantastic people. I think some of them are still at Nestle. Some are now at Gen Mills.
This is just all awesome because, again, as you said, the plan, okay. And it's totally about contingency, right? What if, you know, what, there's so many what ifs here and things could have gone in different ways. And also a credit to you. I mean, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but chutzpah, hustle, whatever you want to say, you know, just sticking your neck out, right? And going on Craigslist and, I mean, sticking your neck out.
Yeah.
You know, but you were safe, thank God. You weren't kidnapped.
Right.
I mean, seriously. Kidnapped. Yeah. I mean, no, just, you know, taking the initiative, as we would say, right? And you did it. And then once in, continuing to do that. Now, when did the business with Target start? Was that part of this business analyst? Oh, by the way, you know, the other thing you just said, trends, you're doing history, right? You're looking at trends over time, change over time. But 100%. So tell us a little bit about how the Target Corporation figured into your work.
So every consumer packaged goods or CPG company has, you know, some kind of sales team that will call on their major customers. So there's usually a Target team, a Walmart team, an Amazon team. And so that was how Target figured in. So while I worked for Nestle, my customer was Target, which means, you know, when I'm thinking about candy, I'm thinking about which, you know, what's the assortment at Target? Is it optimized? We have new items that we want to sell in. Which items are we going to take out? Which items does Target want us to take out, right? So just really, it's both about making sure that Nestle is successful and that Target is successful with the product that you're selling.
Okay. And did that require you to, I mean, you literally go to the stores, I assume, and
sometimes take a look? You meet at Target headquarters a lot. So okay. Both while I was working for Nestle and Clorox, I spent a lot of time at Target HQ because that's where you're meeting your buyers, right? You're meeting your logistics analysts on the other side of the table from you and making sure the business is running smoothly. But yeah, sometimes you do go store visits. I remember, so the role after the business analyst role, I was a junior account manager, a customer development account associate. They're kind of interchangeable titles. But I was working on the pizza and ice cream desk, which is probably my second most fun job because pizza and ice cream.
But I went into the wrong field, clearly.
the best thing is either when you have to do like a competitive tasting, like the competitor, so Unilever comes out with a new ice cream. You're like, I got to go try that.
It's all part of the job, right?
Yeah. Or your own company is coming out with, you know, a new product and they want your feedback on it, right? That's never a bad day.
You know, this reminds me when we had lunch, you were, I just came back to you. One of the things you were saying is, you know, one of the perks of the job is ice cream, and you may have said pizza
all the time.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So,
but you know, the other side of that is, you know, there's very, not, thankfully not very frequently, right? But in the food industry, there are recalls. So there was one recall on one of our pizzas that, I forget whether it was plastic or glass, but something got into one of the spinach pizzas.
Something not
that,
good.
Okay. Yeah, something that you would not want to ingest got into one of the spinach pizzas. And we were literally at stores pulling affected product off the shelf. So it was a really great opportunity. I worked there for the first 7 years of my career, which is unusual for a millennial who graduated in 2010, right? Millennials get a bad rap of hopping around. I think it's, you know, if it's beneficial to you to hop around.
Totally. And that's, I couldn't agree more. I tell students, so I may have even told you, you might have eight careers supposedly.
Right.
But so when you, back to Target headquarters, so when you're meeting with those, first of all, I'm just always interested in how people work and what they do. Mm-hmm. But so that's where this is coming from. When you are, so you're meeting with your Target counterparts, whatever they're called. Are you actually having to, like make a sales pitch about products?
Yes.
You are, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Here's, and forgive me, it's been a while since I worked in that space. But, you know, talking about sales velocities, right? Talking margin is always a conversation you're having with your customer. Okay. And basically, you know, you're saying, I want to bring in these five items. You only want to bring in three. How do we get where we both need to be so it's beneficial for the both of us? And to back that up, you of course have to have data.
Data. God, and you know, did you take any math courses at Castaneda?
I didn't. I just love this.
I mean,
the one requirement, because we're all required to take a math course.
Yeah, one, yeah.
I took Nature of Math, which is not, it's a math course for people who aren't good at math.
I mean, you weren't a business major or minor or econ or management or any of this.
You know,
that's what I love about this story. Yeah. And here, you know, again, I mean, talk about data. The data is there. Humanities majors do really well in the corporate world. You're just one great example. So from that business analyst position, did you go from there into, was that with Nestle and Clorox, that position?
Yeah. So I was I started as an admin with Nestle. I moved into a BA role at Nestle, and then I was the junior account manager role at Nestle. Then I actually left Nestle for Merrill Corp, now DataCite. I was a senior sales planning analyst there for about a year. I missed the CPG industry. So I was like, well, I'm going to go work for Clorox. And that was the senior sales analyst role there. I was there for about 15 months. I wanted to stay there longer. It was just not a good every kind of toxic corporate trope you hear was happening there. I was like the sixth or seventh person to leave that office. not just leave the office, but leave the company in, I want to say, like 8 or 9 months. So it definitely wasn't just me. And again, talking about, you know, I think the theme of this conversation is the plan didn't work out.
Yeah, which is great. I love it. No,
exactly. I had planned to, you know, return to the CPG industry and be there for a long time, and it just didn't work out. And that was a really critical time in my career because I was failing big every day. not because I didn't have the technical skill set, but because I didn't have the skills to navigate that kind of environment, right? Mm. And so I had really had to challenge my perception of failure and say, you know, are you failing because you're a bad person and because you're stupid? No, you're just, it's okay to fail, and it's okay to ask for help, and it's okay to for something not to work out even though you really want it to. So at kind of at the end of that time that I was at Clorox, this is an important lesson for everyone. Don't ever, unless you really, really hate where you were and you don't ever want to go back, don't ever burn your bridges, because I was sitting at my desk in my Clorox office and I emailed my manager at DataCite, and I knew he still hadn't filled my role. And I messaged him and I was like, hey, you know, can we have a conversation? I think I want to come back. Are you open to me coming back? Can we talk about it? And within a half an hour, he said, let's have lunch. And I think 2 or 3 weeks later, I was back at DataCite, working for him as a senior revenue operations analyst. And so I came back in 2019,
yeah.
And then just this past May, so May of last year, I was promoted into a principal revenue operations analyst. So thank
Congratulations.
You. So like, don't be afraid to like, there are a lot of what we call boomerangs at DataCite, right? People who have left and returned. Like, don't be afraid to do that either.
Right. This is, first of all, I don't remember if you had me as a prop, but if you had, I jump out of the chair sometimes in excitement, and I'm half out of the chair right now. I can't get all the way out because I've got to be near the microphone. But I couldn't have scripted this. I mean, what you just said, everything you just said is so valuable and interesting. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it reflects incredibly highly on you. And I'm not just saying that because you're an alum, and I really mean that. One, everything I've read about, and from, I like reading about business people and their lives, and failure is essential. Mm-hmm. And then it's what you do with failure, as you said, how you conceive of it, right? I mean, that no one can succeed without failure. It seems, you know, that's terrifying when our students our students hear that from me.
Especially when they're, up until the point of graduation in college, right? You're operating in a very safe environment.
That's right. Right. That's right. That's exactly right. And then to have the, well, let me back up. How, so from the jump to Clorox, did you just reach out to them? How does it work? Or you just say, oh, I know there's a position opening. It's not on Craigslist at that point.
No. You're asking about when I moved from Merrill Corporation to Clorox.
From Merrill, sorry, to Clorox.
Yeah. Yeah. Like any other job, right? I think at the time it was a LinkedIn application, right? I was not super happy in my role at Merrill Corporation, partially because it was a new role. I wasn't backfilling anybody, right? There wasn't anybody for me to learn from.
Okay.
Other than my wonderful team, right? But it's a little bit challenging when you step into a new role especially if you don't know the industry.
Sure.
And part of it was I was on a business unit that was the performance was not high. And at the Merrill actually ended up divesting from that business unit.
Okay.
While I was at Clorox, and I had I had talked to my manager. He's like, "It's almost good that you weren't here we're not sure you would have been able to stay."
Wow. Good. Again. Wow.
Again, it all works out.
Yeah. But so that's another example of you. Mm-hmm. A person needs to take initiative, right?
Yes.
And do some hustling, whatever you want to call it. I mean, energy, hustle isn't energy. You know, you just need to do it, not wait for things to fall into your lap. They might not. So
having internal locus of control is like a blessing and a curse, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I credit with the hustle or the initiative or whatever you want to call it, right? Like I make things happen.
Yes.
The downside of that, right? Like everything is my fault. That's the problem with internal locus of control.
All right. But there's therapy for that. You can do that.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting because I have a brother who's about 2 years younger than me, and he's like 8,000,000% external locus of control. And he gets really frustrated because his life is, he's a lot more free and easy, right? So has a little bit calmer life. But he gets frustrated when things aren't happening for him. And for me, my natural reaction is, we'll just go make it happen.
You'll make it happen.
So just being aware of your own personality and like your own worldview, right? The things that make you, is really critical when you're thinking about how you want to approach your career, because you need to know what your, kind of natural inclinations are, right? If you are an internal locus of control person, great. You're probably going to make things happen sooner, but you also need to be aware of the drawbacks of that. And if you're an external locus of control person, right, you need to understand, how to leverage your own personality and skills to your own benefit, right?
Yeah.
And there's 8,000,000, personality. I love a little pop sci, right? Like Myers-Briggs types.
Oh,
all over that.
Yeah, I think I saw that your resume.
I put it on there.
Yeah.
Along with like a couple other ones, right? But just
knowing
yourself is so important.
Yeah, you avoid, first of all, exactly, for a lot of reasons, including avoiding a mismatch, right? That
mm-hmm.
can lead to you profound unhappiness. I just love this stuff. It's great advice. I'm now, the reason I'm pausing is I'm fantasizing for you on your behalf about you being a, wealthy career consultant person, because you really understand, seriously. I mean, I'm thrilled you were doing the mentoring. By the way, that was meant to ask you about that. The mentor.
I need to pick that back up.
Yeah, please do, because you're an excellent mentor, and the students need to hear what you're saying. What
is?
Let's talk.
A lot of joy, and it gives me a lot of joy to do that. But it also is really important for students to understand how important networking is.
That's right.
And it's like I don't do a very good job of it myself. I was just in Phoenix last week for a work trip for a sales kickoff, and that was my challenge. It doesn't sound like it when I talk to people, but I'm a huge introvert. I get really depleted by talking to people all day, and I just had 2 or 3 solid days of that last week. So I've recovered, is what I'm telling
Thank you.
Thank
you for speaking to me.
You're welcome. But just especially if you're not a natural extrovert, right? Understanding how to network as an introvert, understanding how to network overall, because it's this big, like scary bugaboo term, right? And it doesn't have to be scary.
Oh,
there's really easy ways to do it.
I'm smiling. I'm shaking on my hand because yes, this is so true. It's what I tell them. It's okay. It's not a bad thing, right? And I was not good at it. I'm maybe less so now, but I'm shy and it was really hard for me to do. Mm-hmm. Still is, but I love doing it for people. I love connecting people. That is why. Yeah. Thank you. Very, very important lesson. In the time remaining, I want to ask you two things. One, What is it you do now? So what is a revenue operations analyst? Sure. What does that involve?
I do a lot of things. And it's evolved a little bit as our business changes, right? As I've moved into a little bit, as I got promoted and moved into a little bit different capacity on the same team. Our primary function on our team, right, is quota setting. So for our selling force, right? So maybe an important distinction is I'm no longer the person selling to the customer. Kind of taken a step behind the scenes. It's a much better, like I said, I'm not an extrovert. So it actually is a much better fit for me to be on the operations side of things instead of in sales proper. So that's a huge benefit to me. But a good chunk of our year is setting our quotas for our sellers. So we have, you know, a tops down budget. We say to sellers, this is how much you have to sell. Right. And then we generate their compensation plans from that information. And so it's very, very tied into both our performance as a company and how our sellers are going to get paid, which is, you know, believe it or not, sellers really care about how much they're going to get paid and they want clear goals so they know how to reach that.
This is so interesting. Yeah. So is data side basically, it's like a financial services company, or how would you describe
it? Yeah, back in the day, when we were Merrill Corporation, we were a financial services company. Now we're in the SaaS world, so solution as a service. Our primary product is our data room, virtual data room, which is, you know, we do a lot of our primary product, the virtual data room, is designed to facilitate merger and acquisition transactions, right? So, you know, when let's use Nestle as an example, right? Divesting there. I'm not sure if they were ever a customer for us. That's my disclaimer. But when they divest of a business unit, right? Back in the day, you used to have to get the lawyers and the investment banker and everybody, you know, everyone all in a room and do it all on paper. Now this is all happening. Everybody's familiar with the cloud, right? This is all happening virtually now. People can get access to the data room. And it sounds kind of like, well, why would anybody sell that if there's a cloud? I don't know if you know anything about regulatory compliance, but there's a lot of rules and there's a lot of things to make sure, you know, people are doing things on the up and up. And so just to plug DataSite a little bit, our product is amazing, right? We have a lot of features that enable M&A transactions to be successful.
That's cool.
So like redaction is one of, we're using AI to great effect, right? Redaction is one of them. It's a really important tool for the business of the world that is happening, right? So you hear about mergers and acquisitions all the time. If DataSite's not involved in that transaction, chances are they're going to be, right? If they're not, we know about it.
That's very interesting to me. So I think of mergers and acquisitions. I think of lawyers involved.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, here's this huge piece of it that I also love how people come to people, groups, companies, occupy a market niche. You know, I just love that. So someone realized DataSite and the product that you now sell was necessary, useful. I assume so. You cover all the regulatory stuff and help.
I do not. No, thank goodness. I don't have the energy for that.
Does DataSite do that as part of their product, or
they make it? They so there are regulators right within the government that are looking out. But what our project does is makes it easy to ensure that the people who need to do that kind of stuff have access to it, right? Whether it's the auditor, the regulator, or whomever.
Fantastic.
So yeah, our security is best in class, right? That's another huge thing where people say, well, virtual data rooms are everywhere, right? Like, why wouldn't you just load it to Box or the whatever cloud application you're using? And it's like, no, but it has to be secure. You can't just have data running around everywhere.
This is the thing with data. By the way, there was a Nobel conference, but not that long about
it. And I missed it, and I'm so upset.
I might have missed.
I just didn't have time.
Big data or data. Yeah. What? Just to finish DataSite. This is a local company, right? Minnesota based.
Yeah, Minnesota based. Yeah, cool. It started as Merrill Corporation, I believe, in the 70s. We rebranded to DataCite in early 2020.
Okay.
We're headquartered in downtown Minneapolis, but we have a global presence across the globe. So and this is what I really there are a couple of things I really love about working for DataCite. One is that we have an incredible global presence. So you heard me mention I was in Phoenix last week. We have, you know, offices in Europe. We have offices in Asia. We have offices all over the U.S. We have an office in Latin America. We have offices
truly
everywhere. Yeah. And so even there's a member of my team that I talk to every day who sits in London, which we talk about return to office. We mentioned that a little bit earlier prior to the recording.
Right.
And it's like, it doesn't make sense for me to come into the office if I'm speaking with, you know, everybody that I'm going to talk with isn't going to be there anyway.
Right. Yes.
But it's the opportunity that I have to speak to different people from different places with different backgrounds is just incredible. I love talking. Like, I have one manager that I'm fairly close with who sits in France, and I just love talking to her.
Oh.
We don't speak in French
because
my
you.
French okay. is really bad, and I don't want to upset her. and the other thing that I love about working for DataCite is we have an enormous variety of backgrounds. So even just this morning, before I started speaking with you, our HR team was doing a training on career development, right? And one of the people that was, you know, tapped to speak for the career development had been working in medicine, and now she's an IT manager. And there are people like that. I like to say, like, everybody at DataCite has like a secret, not in a negative way, but they have like a secret past or like a secret
you
hobby.
Predict. Yeah, you wouldn't predict. There's not a straight line from what they were doing to DataCite. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll love to hear this. So another member of my team is actually a Gusty and also a history major. So I might need to set you up with her.
Oh yeah, please.
But yeah, there's people, we kind of joke on my team. Our VP is really the only, our VP and one of our team members have an accounting degree and I think an economics degree respectively, but the rest of us are, we have one English major, two humanities majors, and a law degree. So
love it.
And that's just our little team, right?
So that's just one team.
It's wonderful. The breadth of experience and how people think about approaching problems is wonderful.
Perfect. I mean, perfect segue to the last question I had. And
sure.
I know we've kind of touched on this all throughout the conversation, but your pitch for the liberal arts in Gustavus. I mean, you know, again, no one could predict, you know, what are you going to do with that, Allie? What are you going to do?
Right.
Right here you are. You're doing quite.
I'm going to make some money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, you did in that quote. I did love how you used the word lucrative. Yes,
mm-hmm.
but you know, if you had to make an elevator pitch, right, to a prospective or a parent, what would you say?
We talked a little bit earlier, right, about Gustavus being a really safe place to explore and figure out what it is that you want. We talked a little bit about the value, right, of the actual financial piece and how many students do receive aid. I would just say Gustavus really sets you up to be a lifelong learner. So for example, in my free time, I garden, vegetable garden, like on a little bit of a ridiculous scale. My garden's bigger than my house.
Oh, I got to talk to you. We're in a community garden. That's another.
Oh, yeah. We have a whole nother 2-hour conversation about that. But recently I just started Introduction to Food Science and Technology certificate through the Ohio State University.
I saw that on your resume.
Yeah. Because I was like, well, I love this gardening thing and I have an interest, so why not do it? And it never entered my mind that I wouldn't be able to do it. Because what I learned at Gustavus was if I can think about things properly, meaning from a, you know, a liberal arts and critical thinking point of view, I can do anything. I can learn anything. And so having that education, whether it's from Gustavus or another liberal arts college, and having that foundation of kind of, I'm not sure the right way to say it, but just that self-confidence, right?
Yes.
To know how your brain works and how you can take in information and how you can leverage it to your advantage in almost any situation. I mean, we've just spent the last hour talking about how I had no sales or I had no sales background, right? And here, no sales and no data background, right, other than, you know, leveraging what I could from my history major. And here I am. And so this, it really enables you for success in your life, because if you can continue to learn, there's not anything you can't do.
Oh, I love that, man. Awesome.
That doesn't mean I'm like, look at, I had a little, that doesn't mean I didn't struggle with the chemistry.
Of course not. No, of course. No, right. I mean, that, but that's life too, right? I mean, some people think, oh, I don't want to have any friction in my life. Well, then I sometimes say, well, then I don't know, death maybe. I'm not even sure about that.
Well, then you're going to be really bored.
Yeah. Like, you're going to be bored out of your mind. Exactly. No, that's beautifully said.
Bored and stagnant. Have fun.
Bored and stagnant. You gave me three or four possible titles for this episode of what you just said at the close there. So thank you. This has just been so much fun. First of all, I just love your energy. I really do. It makes me feel energized. Two, your smarts and just all that you've done. And again, just the absolute, you know, you're just a, I don't know if I told you, I got to read your quote in front of the faculty meeting once.
Oh gosh.
Old quote. No, it just gave me such intense pleasure, you know, because, you know, there are, you know, in any campus, there are some facts, certainly students, right, who think, what are you going to do with that degree, you know, but, you know, my answer, which isn't always satisfying, is, well, what do you want to do, right? There's nothing.
Right.
And by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, did anyone ever say to you, I'm sorry, Allie, we can't hire you because you were a history major? They might express surprise or
not a once.
Not a one, yeah.
So not a once.
I'm quoting you.
Like tomorrow. I don't know if this is still the case, right? It's been a long time since I either changed jobs or changed companies. But there's still some truth to, regardless of what, you know, if you're gonna be a doctor, this doesn't hold true, so ignore that. But just having the degree will open a lot of doors for you.
Right,
now, as you start to refine what it is you want to do, generally, that, you know, I mentioned my best friend is a social worker. I certainly couldn't do her job, right? There's specialized training that is required for certain roles. But it's actually interesting that you say that, because I am conducting some interviews on behalf of one of my counterparts in another function, and one of the candidates put his alma mater on there and the year that he graduated and the location, but he didn't put the major.
A major. Huh.
And I thought that was really unusual. So I asked the interviewing manager, like, hey, did he ever tell you what he went to school for? And he goes, well, he went to school for psychology. He just didn't put it on there. And I went, okay, why? Like, that's a great conversation point of,
yes,
if you have this degree, tell me how, just the exact conversation that you and I are having, right? Tell me how you got from there to here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's another lesson for people. That can be, far from working against you, can be an asset, a conversation.
Right.
Yeah. It's just, you know, We have a constant battle to convince people. And this goes way back. My God, it goes back to the 17th, 18th century. What are you going to do with these useless humanities?
You know. It's only useless if you make it useless.
Yeah. Oh, another good title. Thank you. Awesome. This has been fun and a pleasure.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of you. And
thank you.
Continued good luck at DataCite and wherever else, you know, your path takes you. You'll do fine. I know that. Yeah, my pleasure. It's really been
fun. I'm very glad we for the listeners, you probably don't know this, but it took us a couple first starts to get to recording. So
it was
absolutely
persisted.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Allie. All right, take good care. See you in person at some point.
Sounds good. Thanks,
right,
Greg.
Bye bye. See ya.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is supported by the Offices of Marketing and Communication and the Provost. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus itself.